You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Jeffrey Kine, filling in for Stephen Dynan, and I welcome everybody to tonight's teleseminar. We are delighted to welcome Rihanna Eisler, president of the Center for Partnership Studies, and author of the best-selling The Chalice and the Blade, Our History, Our Future. And so in a few moments, I'm going to turn things over to our host, Bellevue Rooks, and we will then enjoy about 40 minutes of dialogue before we open it up for questions from our audience. First, I just want to remind everyone who is speaking to please keep your voices nice and loud throughout the teleseminar so that everyone can hear you and so that it turns out well on the recording. So, Bellevue, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Jeff, and I'd like to thank all of you for joining us, and I'd especially like to thank Rihanna Eisler for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Just by way of introduction to today's discussion, I'd like to point out that I was thinking earlier that so much of the officially sanctioned and celebrated version of Western civilization and history has a lot to do with competition, violence, battles, conquests, and this kind of ongoing struggle for dominion and domination. And our guest today, as many of you know, has devoted a lot of her work to trying to create what she has described as a more gender holistic society. And as Jeff has pointed out, she is the founder of the Center for Partnership Studies and just the amazing and wonderful book that many of you know. And for those of you who don't, I certainly hope you will become familiar with it as soon as you can, because it's a very important book and one in which Princeton anthropologist Ashley Montague once described as the most important book since Darwin's Origin of the Species. Some of Rihanna's other books include Sacred Pleasure, as well as Tomorrow's Children, A Blueprint for Partnership Education in the 21st Century, which is also one of my favorites. She is co-editor of a wonderful and important collection entitled Educating for a Culture of Peace, and she is co-founder with Nobel laureate Betty Williams of the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence. So with that introduction, I'd just like to say welcome, 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 Rihanna. This is a huge pleasure and a great honor.
It's a pleasure for me to be with you.
Just to move into the discussion, one of my other favorite books of yours, Rihanna, is your wonderful memoir entitled The Gate, A Memoir of Love and Reflection. And I was wondering if we might begin with your life and some of your life experiences and your personal journey that might have helped shape both your work and your understanding of the term spiritual courage.
Well, my life is, as I have written in several places, really started in Vienna, in Austria, during a time when, in terms of the conceptual framework that my work introduces, the domination system versus the partnership system as two underlying possibilities for structuring beliefs and institutions and relations, it was really a time of massive regression to the domination model. It was the rise to power of the Nazis, first in Germany and then in my native Austria, so that from one day to the next, really my whole world collapsed. I mean, we like to talk today about turning points. Very early, that was a huge turning point for me. And we really only escaped by a hair's breadth. Some of our listeners may know that there was the first systematic terrorism against Jews, so-called Kristallnacht, because so much glass was broken in Jewish homes, in Jewish synagogues, in Jewish businesses. On that night, a band of Gestapo people came and dragged my father away. And it was only by a miracle that my mother was able to obtain his release. And that term that you mentioned, spiritual courage, is really a term that stems from what she did, which is she stood up to them, and she could have gotten killed, and she demanded that he be returned. And, well, I mean, part of it, I think, was that she looked very much like the Aryan poster woman, you know, blonde, blue-eyed, pink-cheeked, although she was Jewish. Part of it was, I think, that her authority, you know, the authoritarian dominator personality, response to authority, part of it was greed. You know, she had to pay to get him back. But I called what she did spiritual courage, and it was her spiritual courage, without which we would have all been dead, because if he had been sent to a concentration camp, as so many men, 40,000 Jewish men were that evening, we would have stayed behind hoping vainly, but we wouldn't have known that, for his release, and eventually we too would have been sent to the gas chambers. So that experience was really pivotal in my life because it brought up questions, questions that we've all asked, questions about when we humans have such a great capacity for caring, for empathy, for nonviolence, why has there been so much violence, so much cruelty, so much insensitivity? Is it inevitable, or are there alternatives? And if there are alternatives, what really are they?
What are they? How old were you, Rian, when this experience occurred?
I was 7.
You were 7, and you actually set out, your family set out on a journey that placed you in a different culture, different languages, different... I was thinking when I was rereading The Gate in preparation for this conversation that you really... an important part of that journey for you was kind of functioning at the intersection of all these different cultures and realities, really, as an immigrant.
Well, yes. I mean, we like to talk today a lot about, you know, cross-cultural experiences. Of course, mine wasn't voluntary. We were very fortunate. We were on one of the last ships before one to Cuba, to Havana, before one that was turned back, the St. Louis. You may remember there was a movie made about it called The Voyage of the Damned, and it was the Voyage of the Damned because of the almost 1,000 Jewish women, men, and children on that boat were not permitted to land in Cuba or in any other port in the Western Hemisphere, including the United States. So the ship had to sail back to Europe, and of course many of them then were killed in Nazi concentration camps. And I remember standing on the quay looking out.
Standing on what?
Well, I called it the quay, on the Palisades.
Mm-hmm. In Cuba, in Havana.
In Havana. Mm-hmm. Horrified by the fact that, you know, there was a lot of despair, really, on the part of my parents and other Jewish immigrants that this was happening. And it was orchestrated by the Nazis, really, who mounted two things. One, a tremendous anti-Semitic campaign, and two, a lot of bribery of the Cuban authorities.
Mm-hmm.
To do this. And I just couldn't understand how it was possible that they wouldn't let this ship of refugees land. And, of course, in the back of my mind was also the knowledge that it could have been my parents and I,
mm-hmm.
if we had just been on a somewhat later ship.
Mm. It was hard for me to, I sat up basically one night reading The Gate because I felt it gave me greater insight into you and your work, and the fact that you were in Cuba. How long were you there? And then you eventually, your family immigrated to the United States.
Yes, I was there another 7 years. You know, that magic number 7 somehow. There have been a lot of 7s. In my life, and of course those were critical ones. And I grew up in the slums of Havana, in an industrial section of Havana. This was before Castro, long before Castro. I mean, we left long before Castro. It was under Batista. He was the latest one, but really it was under regimes that were very exploitive of the Cuban people. There were tremendous, sort of thing that we still see so much in the world today, gaps between haves and have-nots. And a strange thing happened because one of the things in Jewish culture is that education is very, very important. And my parents from the very beginning, I mean, my mother had smuggled out a little bit of jewelry because we had to leave everything behind.
Yes.
You know, the Nazis confiscated it. Well, that's, you know, armed robbery by the government, obviously. Mm. But they just felt that the most important thing for me was to get a good education. So I ended up by having sort of culture shock. Every day I took the streetcar to a private school in the suburbs where, I mean, the very rich lived.
Mm-hmm.
When I say very rich, I mean very rich.
I see.
I mean, it really, the first school wasn't quite as bad, but the second school I went to, it was a Cafe Society school.
Mm.
And, you know, these kids were just, tremendous wealth. And then I would come back to the slums because my parents never moved out of there. My parents were really entrepreneurs. They were, I mean, that was another tremendously important model for me, that you, in adversity, you just dare to do something else. So my parents started a factory of alligator goods and basically revolutionized the alligator goods industry in Cuba, which, when they came, was mostly very touristy, you know, those little baby alligator heads on things, and they started to make very fine purses and other, and so they made money again.
Mm-hmm.
But Cuba for them was a stopping place on the way to the promised land, the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So we never moved.
And you actually went to a Methodist school at one point there?
That was my first school. It was the Methodist school, right. And that was another interesting thing because Methodists sometimes tend to be very proselytizing, and we had to go to chapel. And so I had to laugh about it because it was, you know, they would ask, who believes in Jesus Christ? Well, after a while, I got tired of being the only kid who didn't raise her hand, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I raised my hand, and then my parents heard about it, and they were shocked, and so they hired a rabbi to teach me that I'm Jewish, as if I didn't know by then, right, after
uh-huh.
everything that had happened. And that was another really strange, strange adventure because this, I was one of these pesky kids, very bright kid, and I kept asking questions.
Yes.
You know, like I didn't understand why it was bad to seek knowledge. You know, the Adam and Eve, my parents kept saying, knowledge is good, you know, go to school, study. And I also couldn't understand why a woman would ask advice from a snake. People usually don't do that. So, and of course, what's so interesting is that later, as you know, my research really answered a lot of these questions.
A lot of those questions.
So,
actually, I was struck by the fact